The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm pleased to introduce our guest this evening. Tonight, we're playing our small part in the Leonard Bernstein at 100th celebration. And whom better to discuss the great man than his oldest daughter, Jamie, a celebrated concert narrator, broadcaster, journalist, and radio producer. Her new book, Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein, offers an intimate portrait of a complicated and occasionally tormented artist and father who taught her to love this messy and beautiful world. New Yorker contributor Patty Marks writes, "You think you had a complicated father." In this wry and clear-eyed, ardent, and altogether terrific memoir, Jamie Bernstein lets us in on what it's like to have a childhood as fraught as it was charmed, plus great gossip. Jamie will be in conversation tonight with Peter Dobrin, critic and lover of classical music at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Please join me in welcoming Jamie Bernstein and Peter Dobrin.
Thank you. I mean, first of all, it's terrific to see so many people here for classical music, and I wanted to thank the Free Library for doing this for classical music, because it's a great way of keeping the community together and interested, so thank you, Free Library, for that.
Hear, hear.
And I wanted to say, Jamie, I was thinking over here, while I was walking over here, about the fact that for so many people, your father's young people's concerts were a really important part of being introduced to classical music. And I was, this is going to make you and I feel kind of old, but I was thinking on the way over here that you were a part of my children's young people concerts, because you did those concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra for a number of years, and in those family Saturday morning family concerts, which were so much fun.
And, they were. Well, I'm glad you took your kids to that. That's great.
Well, you bounced around the stage the way your father bounced around the podium, and it was really, really fun and energetic.
Yes, well, the Mexican jumping bean gene lives on.
That's right. That's right. You know, I wanted to just start off a little bit with a why question. You know, I counted more than 20 books about Leonard Bernstein this morning, and I wanted to know why you chose to write another one. What does this bring to the conversation that others haven't?
That's a good question. I had thought for some time about writing a memoir anyway. And then there was this moment when writing a memoir as the centennial of my father's birth was rolling around, and it just seemed like the time was right. And also, I have a story to tell that nobody else could tell about my dad, because he was my dad. And I get asked this question all the time. What was it like? What was it like growing up in that family with Leonard Bernstein for a father? And so I decided to write the long and juicier answer to that question.
Yeah, it's pretty juicy, I have to say. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I remember at one point in the book you say, "God, he was exhausting." What did you mean by that, and what was he like?
Well, what I meant at that particular moment in the book is that my father, well, for one thing, he was a compulsive teacher. He never stopped needing to share whatever it was he was excited about. That's why he was such a good teacher, why he was so good on television in the young people's concerts, and why he was such a good conductor and such a good rehearser of orchestras, because he just had this overwhelming need to share whatever it was that he was excited about whether it was the Mahler Symphony that he was rehearsing with an orchestra, or whether it was a really good Jewish joke, or a passage in Lewis Carroll, or some vaudeville routine he remembered from his childhood, whatever it was, it all had the same quality of reaching out and grabbing you by the sleeve and saying, listen to this, I have to share this with you. And that's what made him such a wonderful teacher and communicator. But it also meant that he could be exhausting because it never let up. So if you happened to be his offspring, my brother and sister and I were basically receiving that treatment ourselves 24/7 at home. You had to be really careful what question you asked him because you could get an hour-long answer.
You know, Andy mentioned the word clear-eyed, I think, in introducing the book, and I think what's so interesting about it is it avoids a lot of pitfalls when people are writing about somebody who's close to them. I mean, on the one hand, you write about him with a great deal of warmth and admiration. It's really, really clear. The love really comes off of the page.
That's good. I meant that.
But at the same time, it was really, really challenging and really, really complicated. He was a presence. He was around a lot, especially for a guy who traveled as much as he did. But he was high maintenance.
Yes, he was high maintenance. And it's true that he was on the road very often, sometimes for weeks at a time. But when he was home, he was really home. And I can't think of a moment for myself or my brother and sister when we didn't feel completely welcome in his presence. He was always really happy to have us around and really loved spending time with us. So even though he was away a lot, when we were with him, we were really with him, and he was really with us. And he often invited us along to accompany him on his own work experiences. He invited us to rehearsals. He invited us to go on tours with him, and that was really fun, to accompany our dad when he toured with the New York Philharmonic, for example. Oh, it was just a nonstop wonderland of fun for my brother and sister and me. You can imagine, it was all first class on the plane, and, you know, the hotels were fabulous, and we were taken, you know, to special, you know, tourist sites without having to wait on lines, and, you know, all that really good stuff. And I will say that I think one of the reasons that our dad loved having us along was that it allowed him to re-experience the fun and the VIP-ness of it all through our eyes, because he actually never got over it himself. And, you know, when we got to the Savoy Hotel, he couldn't wait to ring the bell cord for the head waiter or show us how fabulous the water pressure was in the bathtub. And, like, he just thought it was the coolest thing himself, and he couldn't wait to share it with us.
You know, one of the themes that I think evolves through the entire book is I feel like at the beginning of the book, you're really uncomfortable with being his daughter and identifying sort of yourself through him. You want to be your own person. You want to separate. You want to individualize. And I feel later in the book, you come to terms with it and you embrace that. Can you talk a little bit about how that evolution happened?
Yeah, well, this is one of the things that the book is really about, was how I figured out how to navigate living in this blinding sun. And, you know, we were all sort of like satellites revolving around this blinding sun. And how do you figure out how to be on your own when you live in that intense light? And it took a long time for me to figure it out, and I made things doubly hard on myself by deciding at some point to be a musician myself. And that truly drove me crazy, because on the one hand, I was really musical. I have a good ear, and I loved music, but it was very hard to make music with my own body and be comparing myself, making those odious comparisons, and always feeling like I couldn't measure up which I couldn't. Let's face it. And so it drove me crazy to even be trying. And so the image that I use in the book is it was like having one foot on the accelerator and the other foot slamming on the brake simultaneously all the time. And, you know, that'll really wear you down. And so how I made my peace with music over the years is another way of saying how I managed to figure out how to coexist with this very bright light. And it was very hard for a large part of my life, but there came this moment, it was after my father had died, and I was now, you know, getting into my own middle age, when I realized that my anxiety was subsiding and that it was becoming less fraught to be the daughter of this famous person. And instead, it was starting to be kind of an interesting thing to talk about and share. And like, it wasn't my problem so much anymore. It just became something that was actually interesting. And it seemed so interesting that it seemed worth sharing and talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth reflecting for a moment on who he was. I mean, I know everybody here knows who he was, but in the context of the times, you know, there had not been an American music director at a major orchestra.
There was no such thing as an American conductor. On November 14th, 1943, when my dad had to step up on the podium in Carnegie Hall and conduct the New York Philharmonic because Bruno Walter got sick, and this concert was broadcast nationally live on the radio, and that's really what catapulted him to fame. And one of the reasons that he wound up on the front page of the New York Times the next day, it wasn't just because, you know, somebody took over for Bruno Walter. That wasn't the news. The news was that it was an American-born 25-year-old kid, son of Jewish-Russian immigrants. That was a really big story.
Right.
It had never happened before.
And what made him exceptional continued to grow through his career. I mean, the way he straddled classical music and pop music in a very sort of, you know, in a way that nobody did then, and very few people still do now. And I'm struck. I keep on thinking about one image in the book about how widely his name was known, because you talk about when his casket was moved after the funeral, and there were construction workers by the side of the road who were
waving
off
their hard hats,
saying goodbye, Lenny. And it's just, you know, it's really hard to think of a classical music figure today who might have that kind of name recognition and that kind of love on the part of the public. Just when you talk about this bright sun, you know, that's sort of the big context.
That's true. And now that it's his centennial, it's this amazing and, as my sister says, unrepeatable opportunity for us to remind the world of who he was. And so we've been thinking about it a lot and talking about it a lot, and we realized that the word I find myself using all the time is not a word my dad knew in his lifetime, but that word is broadband. He was so multifarious, you know. He wasn't just a conductor. He was also a composer, and he wasn't just a composer of one kind of music. He wrote symphonies, he wrote Broadway shows, he wrote ballets, he wrote operas, he wrote a film score. I mean, he was all over the place, broadband as a composer alone. And then not only was he a conductor and a composer, he was an educator. And those young people's concerts that you mentioned, they had such an incredible impact in this country, actually around the world, but especially here. And I've only started realizing it over the past 10 or 15 years, the degree of the impact, because when I go around narrating concerts, all these people in the audience come up to me and they say, it's because of your dad's young people's concerts that I'm a music fan today. And the musicians in the orchestra tell me the same thing. I lived in, you know, Podunk, North Dakota, and we didn't have an orchestra, but I watched the young people's concerts on television, and that's how I fell in love with classical music, and that's why I went to conservatory, and I'm in this orchestra today. And I started to realize that the impact was enormous. And I think to this very day, I dare say a lot of the butts in seats of concert halls are there because of the Young People's Concert.
Right. I'm sure you're right.
To this very day.
I'm sure you're right. I thought the scenes of you taking your father to the Fillmore in New York were hilarious. And I just love the image of him going to hear the Rolling Stones and admiring Tommy, the rock opera, and later Michael Jackson. But I was, and I know you're going to read from the book in a moment, but I wanted to read one little passage because I think it says so much about his influences. We're talking here about the Bernstein Mass. And you say, Mass was the piece in which my father's fascination with rock music was finally going to express itself through a composition of his own. He really believed that the pop music of the day contained more creative energy than the so-called serious music coming from the new generation of conservatory-trained composers. Ironically, the very composers whom, as the conductor of the Philharmonic, he was passionately committed to presenting. And, you know, I thought that was so interesting because to this day, I don't know of another composer who has integrated pop music into so-called serious music in the way that your father did. Can you talk a little bit about how he talked about that?
Yeah, I can. 'Cause it's very germane to the way composers compose today. Back in the middle 20th century, if you wanted to be considered a so-called serious composer, you absolutely positively had to write atonal, 12-tone music. That was what was approved in the halls of academe. And my father was perfectly capable of writing 12-tone music, and he wrote it. He put it in many of his works, but he never wanted to feel that he had to do it exclusively. He mixed it up. That was his whole thing, was taking down the walls between genres in everything he did. But the minute he did that, he knew consciously that he was automatically disqualifying himself from being included in the pantheon of so-called serious 20th century composers. But I think he got the last laugh, because by now, you know, contemporary composers no longer are in that 12-tone straitjacket. Today's composers can write in any genre or a bunch of genres that they wish, and they mix up the different styles without thinking twice about it, and it doesn't jeopardize their reputations at all. And in fact, so many of today's composers look to Leonard Bernstein as the model for the kind of musician they want to be now and the kind of composer they aspire to be. So he's actually a much better role model and a more relevant role model for them than any of those 12-tone composers are by now today.
Right, right. You know, one of the other interesting things about the book that I feel you pulled the curtain back on, and I don't even know if you know how unusual this is you wrote quite a bit about the inner workings of the music business, the agents, all of the machine that was in place to keep the industry going. And, of course, that was the golden age of that machine. You know.
Yes, that's true.
Those agents and managers.
And record companies.
And record companies, yeah.
Because that was the golden age of record companies, too, back when they had these giant budgets and could afford to, you know, record orchestras and send them on tour and all the rest of it.
And there were radio broadcasts to promote and reinforce the recording business. Yeah. It all sort of worked as a piece. But one of the characters that you put your finger on was Harry Kraut, and who was your father's agent, but agent doesn't really quite describe everything that Harry Kraut meant to your father.
Manager was really closer to it.
And I'm wondering if you can describe what that relationship was and talk about, you know, what he did.
Well, it's complicated. And, you know, if you read the book, you'll understand why I say it's complicated. Harry Kraut was a very brilliant man, Harvard-educated, who, before he became my father's manager, was running Tanglewood for the Boston Symphony Orchestra in their summer home. And that's where my father met him, because, of course, my father went up to Tanglewood every summer to teach the kids in the orchestra there, as he called them, because he had had this incredible experience himself as a student when Tanglewood first began, and his conducting mentor, Serge Koussevitzky, had just founded it. So my father had that great experience at Tanglewood as a student, and then he went back for the rest of his life on the other side of that equation as a teacher. And so that's where he met Harry Kraut. And Harry decided to abandon all his other activities that he had been involved with in order to exclusively handle my father's career. And Harry had a big vision and a big idea for how to, you know, promote the brand and make everything mega. And he succeeded enormously. And, you know, looking back on it now, I suppose I should congratulate Harry for everything he did for my father's career and for really leaving a much larger and richer legacy. All those conducting videos that Harry Kraut produced, now I'm so glad they're in the world and they're fantastic. But at the time when we were all living through it, my brother and sister and I were uncomfortable with the way he was, you know, burnishing the Bernstein brand, and it made us very squirmy, because to us he was our dad, and we had to wonder to what extent our dad was buying into this embellishment. It was easier, as I say in the book, to blame Harry for all of it than it was for us to blame our dad for buying into it. So it was complicated, yes.
Right, right. The other person who I think you beautifully brought to light was your mother, who had so much to do with everything. And you focus quite a bit on your parents' marriage and your father's slow evolution in coming out. And, you know, I was wondering, was this a realization, a process you worked through before the book, or was the writing of the book somehow part of your process in dealing with this?
Oh, I think that writing the book certainly increased that process intensely, but it was something that my brother and sister and I had all been going through already. We were evolving with it the whole way along as our father evolved with it. He left our mother in 1976 for 1 year to go off and live with a man that he was very much in love with, who had helped him develop his Norton lectures at Harvard. And so he finally reached this moment where he went off to live with this young man, but it didn't go very well, and my father couldn't really sustain it. So he wound up coming back home after a year. And at that point, you know, we were all so relieved, and it all seemed very happy, but our mother was coughing a lot, and the next thing we found out, she was diagnosed with lung cancer, and a year later she died. So there was this awful concatenation of events, you know, the separation and then the reunion and then our mother's death. So we were processing all of that while it was happening, and then continued to go on processing it after our mother was no longer with us and our father was attempting to live his life more as an out gay man. But, you know, these were early times. This was still in the 70s and the early 80s. Then the AIDS crisis came, and it was all very fraught and very difficult. And the other thing was that my father's mother, Jenny Bernstein, herself an immigrant from Ukraine, who came over here at the age of 8, was still very much alive and very much from the old world. And she outlived her eldest son. And so I think had my father lost his mother before the end of his own life, maybe that would have made it easier for him to live as a gay man. But honestly, as long as Jenny was in the picture, he had to hedge his bets. He just kind of had to. And so I think that really complicated the equation for him a lot.
Right, right. I was really interested in the essay that you wrote recently. It was an excerpt from the book about radical chic and and Tom Wolfe. And I don't know how widely known it is, how many people know about this, but Tom Wolfe, one of his most infamous essays, was a piece that he wrote entitled Radical Chic, where he showed up at a meeting at your parents' apartment that they were giving to raise money for, I believe, 11 men who were charged with various crimes, and all of which turned out to be trumped up, but they were raising money for their legal defense. And part of the, you know, it was interesting writing about what all the issues were, because they still sound very familiar today.
More so than ever.
Poverty and police brutality, and racial profiling, and friction between the police and communities they cover. I mean, it just all sounded like very much today. But your mother, being involved with social justice in the way that she did, wanted to raise money for these men. Tom Wolfe showed up at the party and...
Uninvited.
And I believe he spent the first maybe 1,000 words of the essay talking about the hors d'oeuvres, in particular a blue cheese hors d'oeuvre that was rolled in nuts. And the entire essay was dripping in sarcasm, and it made the case slowly over 18 pages, something like 20,000 words, that this section of New York society was interested in social justice simply because it was the cool thing to do, not because they had any sincerely held beliefs about it. So I want to talk a little bit about Radical Chic, and I want to talk a little about how dishonest Tom Wolfe was in writing this. But I also wanted to read a little excerpt of it, because I think this little excerpt says something about your father. It says something about Tom Wolfe and about just sort of what was in the air at the time. He's talking about your father, and he says, Leonard Bernstein has moved from the back of the room to an easy chair up front. He's talking about what happened at the party. Lenny has sunk down to his hip sockets in the easy chair. They really don't know what they're in for. Lenny is on the move. As more than one person in this room knows, Lenny treasures the art of conversation. He treasures it, monopolizes it, conglomerates it like a Jay Gould as an Onassis, a cornfield of conversation. Anyone who has spent a 3-day weekend with Lenny in the country, by the shore, or captive on some lonesome key in the Windward Islands knows that feeling, the alternating spells of adrenal stimulation and insulin coma as the great interrupter, the village explainer, the champion of mental Giotto, the free analyst, Mr. Let's Find Out, leads the troops on a 72-hour forced march through the lateral, geniculate, and the pyramids of Betts, no breathers allowed until every human brain is reduced finally to a clump of dried seaweed inside a burnt-out husk and collapses, implodes in one last crunch of terminal boredom.
Ouch!
And I think
so
what's...
snarky.
Really, really snarky. But what's interesting...
But
I think,
entertaining. That's what's so insidious about it. You
but
know?
It was a really amusing piece. It was probably the most amusing hatchet job on record. But what it added up to was it made light of this very sincere effort to raise money for social justice. The New York Times, a few days later, wrote an editorial also lambasting your parents for this very insincere effort. And I guess, you know, when Tom Wolfe died, there was a lot of talk about what a great journalist he was and what a great piece of writing this was. And you had a really interesting rebuttal, because you see it from the other side, the effect on the family and how insincere this piece of writing was. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, well, what galled me is that, you know, it was just dandy for Tom Wolfe to write this snarky, amusing essay, which put New York Magazine on the map, because it had really, that magazine had just started out. They were all very young. This is in 1970. And, you know, he didn't give us a thought to how his words might be hurtful to the people he was making fun of. And I just feel like you have to remember, if you're a journalist, how your words can affect people, you know? And I'm sure Tom Wolfe didn't give it a second thought. And he got so much praise and attention from this article. And every time New York Magazine has any kind of a, you know, a round number celebration, they always trot it out again. So, like, it just never would lie down and go away. And so when Tom Wolfe left us about a month ago, and there were all these encomia in the news media, I thought, well, God damn it. I'm just, and I was invited by Katrina Vandenhoevel at the Nation magazine to write something about it. So I said, okay, I'm just going to do this and say it again, because it's worth reminding everyone that, you know, he blithely put this thing out there, A, with no thought to how it might affect the people he was making fun of, and B, I wonder whether he had any clue that he was acting as a complete stooge for the FBI, who were all very busy setting Jews one against the other and Jews as a group against blacks by, you know, fomenting the discord. And Tom Wolfe played right into that game of the FBI's, whether he knew it or not.
Right. Do you think he had regrets about stepping a little bit into the political arena, your father?
Did my father? Well, I don't think he really thought about it in terms of regret. Mm-hmm. He spent his whole life always speaking out and standing up whenever he perceived an injustice or saw someone in need or an issue that needed to be spoken about. He was just out there on the front lines, and that's just the way he was from his earliest adulthood. He would give his name to any organization that he felt was doing a good thing, and as a result, the FBI was keeping tabs on him since the 1940s. So by the 1980s, decades later, when he was finally able to view his FBI file through the Freedom of Information Act, he discovered that it was 800 pages long. And if you go to the National Museum of American Jewish History right down the street here, you can see that FBI file. It's part of the exhibit. And it's a fantastic exhibit. I urge you all to take a look at it. Anyway, that FBI file is right there, and you can flip through it. Very redacted, of course. Lots of things, you know, with a black marker going through it. But you'll get the idea.
You know, I'm thinking also about 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, which was a musical that was actually had a tryout here in Philadelphia before it went to New York.
That's right. It was here first.
And it was a tremendous flop. I think it ran about a week, maybe a little less. But what was really interesting about it, I think, is that it did something, you know, that even today would be considered to be sort of cutting edge and interesting, which is while it told the official history of the White House and the people who occupied it publicly, it was also telling the history of the servants who worked in the White House. You know, I there was one thing that you said, in the book, you said your father actually believed that if he just wrote the right combination of notes, he could unlock the secret to saving the planet. And I'm wondering, you know, did you feel 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue was his effort to do that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that he had this impulse to heal the world through his music. And, you know, he wasn't a crazy person. He didn't actually think he could save the world with a tune. But it was that impulse to heal the world through music that really propelled so much of what he composed. Not just 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but so many of his pieces have this impulse to ask the tough questions, to shake his fist at the heavens. You know, if you're up there taking care of us, why is everything such a mess down here? And what are you going to do about it? And are you up there anyway? You know, all these, you know, these tough questions that so many of us ask ourselves and ask the universe around us. And with 1600, he wrote this show with Alan J. Lerner, of Camelot and My Fair Lady. And the two of them were both in such a state of distress after having gone through Watergate. And there's such a resonance now with what we all went through back then. This sense of despair over a government that was not governing properly, not governing honestly, and the sense of helplessness and despair, and really, it all came back to me as I was writing this book and writing about those times. It all came back to me about how frustrated we were about the Nixon administration, and the parallels to now are incredible and depressing. But in any case, my father and Alan J. Lerner really wanted to say something important about how we had all come out of that experience, and to try and really say something about what you go through to preserve democracy and what a fight it is and what a struggle it is and how you have to, you know, scrape and fight for every inch of progress. And so they were trying to put all those thoughts and emotions into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, talk about a tall order. I think they really bit off more than they could chew. And then they added this extra layer of discourse when they introduced the idea of talking about black people in the United States and the essential tragic flaw of slavery in the history of the United States. And all of a sudden, they were telling a story that was maybe too much for two middle-aged Jewish white guys to be telling. And I just think they set themselves up for this tremendous fall, even though the score and lyrics are fantastic. But the storytelling that they used was so tragically flawed that it just couldn't hold up the score.
Yeah, yeah. He was so politically aware and involved. If he were alive today, what do you think he would be paying attention to? There's a lot to choose from.
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, just in terms of 1600, I'm so sad he's not around to see Hamilton, because that's kind of where he was going.
Right.
And he would have been so thrilled and not a little bit jealous to see how Hamilton threaded that needle and how Lin-Manuel Miranda threaded that needle. I think my father would have been thrilled and also jealous. And then in terms of where we are today politically, he would be apoplectic. And he would be right out there on the front lines making a big noise, marching in the streets and probably writing music to express his outrage and frustration. And part of me really wishes he were here right now, and part of me is relieved that he wouldn't have to see this, because he would be so appalled.
Right. I have one more question for you, and then I would love to hear questions from the audience. My question for you is, for somebody who doesn't know Leonard Bernstein's music, except maybe for West Side Story, name three pieces that you think should be known that would explain together who your father was as a composer.
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, people, it's such a better question than the one I get a lot, which is your favorite piece of your dad's? And I can never answer that question, because it's whatever I just heard. It's my new favorite. So it's always revolving. But if I had to choose three pieces that would kind of illuminate who Leonard Bernstein was for someone, I guess I would point them to Mass, because Mass has so many different elements of my dad in it. In a way, it has more of him in it than any other thing he wrote. It's just got all those elements. It has all the mixing up of the genres. It's got an orchestra. It's got a chorus. It's got a Broadway-type chorus and a kids' chorus and a rock band and a blues band and a marching band and dancers, and I mean, it's got everything. So,
and here we included a klezmer band, by the way.
Right.
Mummers band.
Oh, that's right. Mummers. We have Mummers in Philadelphia.
Right.
So anyway, that's
one piece.
Got so much of my dad in it. And also, you know, his fist shaking at the heavens, it's got that, and everything. So I would steer people to Mass. I would also steer them in his symphonic works. I would steer them to Serenade, which is a kind of violin concerto that is so gorgeous. And it's also got a really broad palette because it has this, it's incredibly lyrical, but it also has these really rollicking movements. So it's got, rhythmically, it's got a really big spectrum of Bernstein music. And then what would the third one be? I don't know. I guess one of the Broadway shows, another Broadway show, maybe On the Town. His first Broadway show is still heaven to listen to. It is so much fun, and the score is so rich. He really used symphonic elements as he wrote that score. And you know, everybody knows the tune, New York, New York, hell of a town. So in that show, he uses the elements, la, 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 New York, New York, as building blocks to the score, just like Beethoven uses ba, 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 ba in Beethoven's Fifth. It's amazing. I don't think anybody else who writes for Broadway does exactly that.
Right.
So maybe those three would be a good introduction.
Yeah, those are great pieces. So we have some people with microphones and would love to hear some questions.
There's that line that Pangloss says in Candide, any questions? I'll be happy to hear. We've all the answers here.
Jamie,
I hope.
Since you mentioned that the score to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is so wonderful, can anything be done to resurrect it?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, my father and Alan J. Lerner were so shattered when the show closed after 8 performances that they couldn't even bear to make a cast album. So that music was lost. But there is a kind of symphonic presentation called A White House Cantata, where a bunch of the songs from the score have been rescued and put together for a sort of evening with an orchestra and vocal soloists and a narrator. And it's hardly ever done, but that would be your only way to hear the songs from that score. There is one song from that score that's actually heard a lot and has been performed a lot this year in the centennial year, and that song is called Take Care of This House. And in the show, Abigail Adams sings it to a little black boy who winds up being one of the servants in the White House. And the words are so pointed, and the metaphor is so relevant to this very day. The words go, take care of this house, keep it from harm. If bandits break in, sound the alarm. Care for this house, shine it by hand, and keep it so clean the glow can be seen all over the land. So when you sing this today, everybody mists up a lot. And thank you, Alan J. Lerner, for those beautiful words. It's really hard to write that kind of lyric that's inspirational and is supposed to mean something elevated, but you have to still keep it kind of, you know, specific so that it doesn't just sound too, you know, airy and general. So I think he did a fantastic job with that lyric.
I noticed tonight and also at your takeover at the National Museum of American Jewish History, you said that your dad was a conductor, a composer, and an educator. But I remember him also as a great pianist.
Oh, that is the fifth thing, you're right.
And I think that needs to be included as well.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. It's
and
true.
Everybody go to the exhibit. It's wonderful.
That exhibit is great. It's true. That's true. So, yes, conductor, composer, educator, humanitarian, and pianist. He really was an unbelievable pianist. And he didn't practice that much. He just kind of had it in his fingers, and he could sit down and play anything just from his ear. And Betty Comden, who was with Adolph Green, the collaborators with him on both On the Town and Wonderful Town, another fabulous musical of my dad's, she tells this story about the night she met my dad. And she was at some party. And really late at night, around midnight, my father shows up at this party, direct from Philadelphia, where he had just seen the out-of-town production of this brand-new musical called Kiss Me, Kate, by a fellow called Cole Porter. So my dad arrives at this party, as Betty tells the story, and he bursts in and he says, "Oh, my God, I just saw the greatest show in Philadelphia. It's called Kiss Me, Kate," and it goes like this, and he goes to the piano and basically plays the entire score from memory. So Betty, as she tells the story, goes home at about 5 in the morning and wakes up her mother and says, "Ma, Ma, tonight I just met a genius." And her mother says, "That's nice, honey," and rolls over and goes back to sleep. That's Betty's story.
Did you feel the pressure to succeed because your father was so famous?
Did I feel a pressure to succeed? Well, that's actually a good question. My parents were not the pushy kind of parents that were always demanding that you do better. But there was this kind of unspoken competitive thing. It was kind of under the radar. It was implicit that we were supposed to do very well. So in a way, we were getting mixed messages, because in the 60s, parents were very permissive. That was the deal back then. So they, for example, our parents did not push us to practice the piano. And possibly as a result of that, we never practiced because we hated our piano lessons and we had terrible attitudes and we really didn't like our piano lessons and we didn't feel this conscious pressure to do it. So as a result, we were all terrible pianists. And we none of the three of us actually became real musicians. I was the one who came closest to it by trying to pursue this career as a singer-songwriter. And I finally just set it aside because it was driving me crazy. So I think the answer is that we were not pushed so much. And that's why, interestingly enough, when I was writing this book, my editor, Jonathan Jayo, who's considerably younger than I am, he's in his 30s, I think, was the person who most pushed me in my whole life. And I handed in my second draft, and he said, "Well, you know, this is an A minus, but I want you to give me an A." And I swear to God, no one had ever talked to me like that in my whole life, certainly not my parents. So I was kind of amazed that somebody was pushing me like that, because I'd never been pushed like that. I was very grateful to him, actually. So I went back to the drawing board, and I worked and worked and worked and worked, and handed in my final draft, and I said, "Is it an A yet?" He said, "Yes, it's an A." And I was like, phew! But really, it was the first time I'd ever been spoken to like that. Amazing. It was partly just the times I grew up in, honestly.
I remember a 10-part series on public radio.
11-part, actually.
11-part, yeah. And I don't know, is it available in any way? That's question one. And in it, there was samples of him playing with you and your siblings on a tape recorder, and there was a talk by Maren Alsop and Bobby McFerrin about how your father affected them as a teacher. Could you talk a little bit about whether that's available and the effect that he either playing with you or what it was like seeing his relationships with his proteges?
Yeah, well, this is not the happiest story in the world. This 11-part radio series was fantastic. The guy who put it together, his name is Steve Rowland, and he's been trying very hard to get that 11-part series out there in the centennial year. And the reason that it isn't out there is that the music licenses were not properly dealt with. And so there are all these legal reasons why it can't be re-released. And we are just heartbroken about this, because It was a fantastic series. You might be able to find a copy of it on eBay or something, maybe. But unfortunately, it can't be, you know, kind of officially put out there again. And he was able, Steve Roland, to get interviews with all kinds of amazing, fantastic people whom we lost very shortly thereafter. Betty Comden and Adolph Green, for example, and Mike Nichols, and many other people who were close to our family who had fantastic stories to tell. And they're all in there. And I wish everybody could hear that now, but it's kind of in this lockdown, legal lockdown. It's heartbreaking. So there you have it.
I think it's difficult to say pick three. The man did so much. I mean, you can't not say West Side Story was by far the first American real opera that we know. I mean, you can go on the classical side.
Well, the first American real opera was Porgy and Bess. Let us not forget. I take your point that.
But my interest, other than the obvious, is talk. I don't know that the book, of course I haven't read it yet, talks at all about the wife and her influence, if there was, in his life. Can you touch on that a little bit? Was she important to him?
Was my mother, you mean?
Yeah.
Felicia? Boy, oh boy, was she important. Yes, and the reason I didn't mention West Side Story in the three is that Peter said, if people only know about your dad through West Side Story, what other three would you pick, right? So that's why I did what I did.
So it was really four.
Okay, so I went with the top four. Okay. My mother, well, again, you'll find out the answer to your question in the book. My mother was an amazing person. She was brilliant and beautiful and elegant and just sort of imbued with this natural grace that made our household such a wonderful place. She just gave our family environment such a kind of delicious warmth and elegance, and that's why everybody always wanted to come over to our house, because, you know, it was a beautiful place visually. It was comfortable and lovely, and she had a great eye for design and detail, so everything always looked great and was comfortable yet lovely and elegant. And also she provided this invaluable stability to our dad and his whole life. He really needed that stability because he was all over the place. And when she died so young, it was a tragedy, not just for the three of us kids growing up, especially my sister, who was only a teenager when our mother died. But it was kind of a tragedy for our dad, too, because he lost his rudder to a great extent.
Might I ask, what does your brother and sister do for a living? And between the three of you, are there any grandchildren?
Are there any what?
Any grandchildren.
Oh, yes. Well, my brother Alexander and sister Nina both live in New York, as do I, and we're very close. Maybe too close. We call ourselves the three-headed monster. And we just love spending time together, and we have clung to our family country house that our parents got when we were very young, and we still have it, and we all gather there every chance we get with our kids. Yes, there are grandchildren. I have a daughter, Frankie, and a son, Evan, and my brother, Alexander, has a daughter, Anya, and my sister, Nina, has a daughter, Anna. It's very confusing about the Anya and the Anna, but I call my nieces my A-girls. And I love them to pieces. We love all these four cousins a lot, and they are wonderful. My brother runs our family foundation, which is actually quite modest. But he runs a much more ambitious big thing that started through the family foundation. It's called Artful Learning. And Artful Learning is a teaching model that's being used in lots of schools around the U.S., and it's based on our dad's philosophies of education. And his whole idea was that the best way to learn a thing was through another discipline. His favorite thing was to make connections between seemingly disparate topics or disciplines. And so the idea behind artful learning is that you connect the entire school curriculum by using the arts or using a work of art that everybody can use as a point of entry to explore everything. And the teachers love it and the kids love it because they all get to create something themselves by using the creative impulse. I'm not explaining it very well, but I suggest you go to artfullearning.org and you can find out how it works. It's really fantastic. And kids retain what they learn because they've actually absorbed it in a creative way. And then they don't forget what they've learned. So artful learning is great. So that's what my brother does. My sister, Nina, is a chef. And she's been working in a program that goes into neighborhoods, tough neighborhoods, where in the high schools, my sister introduces all these ideas about what food actually is and how you prepare it and what healthy eating is about and how it can be done on a very small budget. And she teaches these kids about what food is and how to prepare it. She brings in all the ingredients and they cook stuff together and discover that produce can taste good when it's fresh. And then there's a fantastic mentoring program where these kids who learn about food can then teach it to younger kids in a summer program. So this is what my sister does.
Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thanks. I love it here.
The Curtis Institute of Music. I didn't hear you mention that.
Oh, I didn't mention Curtis, but I should have because my father attended the Curtis Institute of Music for 2 years.
My sister was a friend of his there.
You were?
Yeah.
A friend of his there? That's fantastic. Thanks for showing up today. That's wonderful.
Thank you. I heard of Lenny long ago because my sister's...
I'll just bet you did. That was right after he was finished with college. So imagine this was like 1940. Mm-hmm. That's how long ago it was. Thank you for coming today. That's great.
Hi, my name's Carrie. If you could describe your father in one single word, what would that be? I know there's a lot.
One word
from
only?
From what I've heard. I don't know him, but I've heard a lot, but I'm just curious.
Well, I would say, how about exuberant?
Wow, okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
I taught you in 10th and 11th.
Yeah, point the mic to yourself a little bit.
I taught you in 10th and 11th grade, and I was...
Mrs. Just Hollis!
Yes!
Oh, my God! This is my... Actually, it was 10th and 11th grade. My 11th grade homeroom and history teacher. Shirley Hollis in the house! Oh, I'm so excited! Hi! This is fantastic.
And we never had to ask you to do a work because you had a coterie of friends that pushed each other incredibly, and I only had to ask Socratic questions and run behind you all. They were the class of 1970 from the Brearley School. There were 52 of them, and 13 of them got into Harvard.
That's right. That's what we were like. We were little go-getters and blabbermouths. And so go to the acknowledgments in my book, and you will see the big shout-out for my Brearley teachers. So I hope you will take that to heart. I'm thrilled that you're here. That's great. Wow.
Sadly, because I have reading problems, I won't be able to read the book, but I really do hope that you do an audio version of it.
I did!
You have a great voice, and I would love to hear you tell the story. You did.
I did, and you can listen to it.
That's
so
wonderful.
I'm glad I did that for you.
Thank you all for your questions.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Peter. Very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.